Hello and welcome to another episode of the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at RadioReverb.com, on DAB, on Smart Speaker, and of course on our podcast. I'm Eddie Packham and we're all feeling a little bit humbug in association with oldfootballshirts.com. Well, you could say it's been a week of two halves. First, the jubilation of our win in Athens that saw that we would still be playing European football in the new year. However, that was followed by a defeat against 10-man Chelsea at Stamford Bridge on Sunday in a game that we should probably have got something out of. The games, though, continue to come thick and fast with two home games this week with Brentford and then Burnley visiting the Amex. In other news, boss Roberto De Zerbi has followed the lead of Tony Bloom in picking up the European Coach of the Year in the Golden Boy Awards. Tony Bloom picked up the Best President Award last week. And joining me today is, of course, Alan Wares, and we are delighted to welcome back Judah Chalmers, Alan Wickett, Chief Sports Writer from the Argus, it's Brian Owen. Hello, Brian, how are you?
Got a spare. Hello, how are we doing? Good evening.
We're good. We've discussed this before, haven't we, Brian? But we've been very much enjoying your travel logs.
This is the results of the Athens jury.
it's been good. Hopefully people have been picking up on it, like, and go to the knockout stages. But it's been great fun.
I mean, obviously you've done Marseille, you've done Amsterdam, and now you've done Athens. Well, let's start with Athens first. We'll do a compare and contrast, but just give us your flavour of what you found Athens to be like.
Well, brilliant. Nice weather, nice food, easy to get about, a bit of a buzz, decent prices and loads of sport, and lots of sights to see, of course, which I finally got up to the Acropolis on the last day on the Friday, because it was sort of, I thought it would take longer than it actually did. I think a lot of people said that. It looks harder and it looks like a longer trip than it really is. But it was quite fantastic views. And really enjoyed it. I was staying very central in the Plaka area of Athens, just down from Syntagma. What I've done, I've had the same pattern. I struck on it by accident when I went to Marseille. And the only way to get it there quite cheap was to get there very early on Tuesday and come back on the Friday evening. So I've struck on that pattern. So get there on Tuesday, have a look around, just get my bearings, do some stuff about, you know, look at where the fans are going to be, look at the stadium. At Ajax, I've got a stadium tour, so I've got loads of photos to use during the trip. Then Wednesday is very much match day minus one, they call it. So it's press conference, open training, get hold of some fans if I can, which was harder in Athens because they just sort of dispersed across the vastness of the city. Then you start to think about the match, and then obviously Thursday is fan day, comedy club day occasionally, and then match day. And the difference, I suppose, with Athens was it was like a proper 7:45 evening game when you were there. So that's really it. And then I've had the Fridays in Marseille and the latest one at Athens, where I've stayed there for the whole day as well. So I've got some, you know, follow up and had a look at what the papers were saying and found out what people were saying about the games, and did the newspaper subs of the news, the Argus, in the hotel reception area or whatever, and then got the late flight back. Whereas Amsterdam, I was back home at 7 a.m. on the Friday.
So given that, I suppose each trip had its own stories, its own sort of cultural stuff. It might be a tricky question, but I suppose once you throw in football as well, which of the three gave you sort of, you know, was the best one for you?
I thought about that. Such a hard question, but I did really enjoy Marseille because I obviously speak the language and I knew the city a bit better and could maybe get into the more into it than the others. But then when you go to the others, you sort of know what you're doing a little bit more. It's really hard, but possibly Athens just shades it. But I have to say, of the three clubs, although they were the worst team, Ajax were the most impressive as a club, as a stadium, as a whole institution. It just felt like a massive club and a massive stadium.
Yeah, I mean, we were saying the week after that, Brian, that you get Ajax, you really get a sense of history of the club, and you know, it's called the Johan Cruyff Arena, and everywhere you're seeing is like bust of Cruyff, and then you've got the old pictures with the colour splash of the red in the black and white pictures with the red everywhere, and you know, the grand staircases and everything. It's just a wonderful, wonderful place.
Yeah, it felt huge, and must say, I mean, it's had sort of three incarnations in a way, the velodrome. I hadn't been there since the days of Jean-Pierre Papin or Chris Waddle, when it was, you could actually see bits of the velodrome still there. So that had changed a lot, and that was enormous. And I would say that was probably the best atmosphere. Ajax was probably the best pre-match build-up. If you remember that, AD, that was absolutely... I've never seen so many reporters in a press box getting their phones out and videoing, you know, the old...
Yeah.
What, AD?
Well, all of most people, I don't know if AD was or not. I think he probably was. I certainly did.
There were video.
Well, what's that next to you?
AD.
No, there's a comma in. There was a comma in there, or not a comma, whichever was the correct way. But to come back, I mean, obviously, we want to talk more about Athens, and that was like a really new stadium. By the way, I did visit Panathinaikos' stadium, which looked not new. That looked a fantastic place as well for people who like the older, rough and tumble places.
Yeah,
Ike was it was smaller, more compact, modern, but tight to the pitch. You saw almost overhanging the pitch, and atmosphere was pretty good. It wasn't, I didn't think it was quite up to Marseille, but it was you know, it was 30,000. So
given that you know, you had sort of three obviously separate experiences, now what we haven't really talked about is the natives. Now, we haven't had Marseille at our place yet, but certainly when Ajax came and visited us, notwithstanding that they won, but even before the game, I thought they were a brilliant bunch. So did you feel a sense of welcoming from either the home fans or the home natives that weren't, in, you know, particularly football fans? Was there a kind of a culture of welcoming, or was it... Because, I mean, it sounded like Marseille's, the way you were bussed around, was slightly hostile, but... You know, was there a welcoming attitude from the fans particularly?
Well, I don't really... I can't really comment on that in a way, because I tried to go a little bit under the radar, if you like. For example, when we got to... I got the metro up to Perisos, which is the station for the Ike Stadium. And what happens is you come out of there, you have to go under the railway line, and then you're stuck at a really busy T-junction with a pedestrian crossing. So you're standing for ages. You can imagine the traffic was... chaos, really. It was really busy. It was rush hour, and so you're waiting, and what I didn't realize was there's police on the other side who can just, they've got that chance to sort of eye you up, and anybody who looks, I think it's probably anybody who looks English like me, as soon as you get to the other side of the road, they just said Brighton, and I managed to sort of point at my bag and say journalist, and I went the other way, and then I just sort of melted into the crowd, and that was sort of what I just stay on my own. I'm not talking English, speaking English to anybody. And I did that at Marseille as well, just melted into a crowd. Fortunately, I had the language there, so I did actually stop at a little kiosk right by the stadium and got myself a Merguez Frit and managed to pass. You know, I'm walking in not in a football shirt, and I'm looking like I'm coming home from work, so I'll just say that.
Okay, I mean, Brian, we'll talk about the game itself in a second, but obviously you said that you were there on the Friday after the game. And obviously there was an incident after the game in the stadium where it wasn't the Brighton fans, we have to say, but the tear gassing incident where it was seeping into the stadium. And there's a lot of people that were really, really upset about this. There's a few people that we've heard from that are asthmatic, for instance, and it really affected them quite badly. So what was the fallout on that on the Friday? Did you hear anything?
Only from somebody who lives about two roads away from me, who I saw at the airport. And by that time, I think it had been, that was like 8 o'clock or sort of 6 o'clock on Friday afternoon. And it was like, oh, great game. What a game. You're up, Ryan. Oh, we got tear gas, first time ever. And that was like the down point. And then it was back to, what a game. So I don't know if by that point the shock had been... If it had been, it wasn't like it was going to ruin the trip, but it was obviously a bit of a shock. And in the end, maybe it just goes, adds to the story in a way if you weren't seriously affected. But I know after the game, there was a couple of a little caravan, sort of mobile catering units, and one of them selling beer was still open. And this is sort of outside the end where the Brighton fans were in that corner. I don't suppose Brighton fans could use that facility at all, but Warren from Raider Sussex was over there having a beer, waiting for people, me and Johnny, to come out. I waited for Johnny, but I was walking with Johnny Cancer. I was walking with Johnny. So we saw him. We walked over, and the woman was just closing down. So she served us a beer, and there was a local there, and he was saying, it's just local kids, and don't even call them Ike fans. It's just local kids. Even the Ike fans don't like them, causing this problem. And then by the time I got into the city centre, I'd had a message from the club, club spokesman, basically saying our fans were great, Ike were really good hosts. It was just some idiots and the police, I suppose. I don't know. I couldn't really comment on what the policing did. Obviously, it would have been unpleasant if you were in there. I wouldn't like to say they got it horribly wrong or whatever. But that was all what I knew of it. And actually, my colleague George Carden in the office was dealing with that, and he was contacting fans who were in there. That's probably all I can say about it, apart from it seems like it was a minority of local kids who were a bit excited, and it probably wasn't dealt with that well.
Okay, well let's look at the game itself. Then Albion through to the knockout stages. Hopefully, a victory over Marseille on the 14th of December will see us top the group and avoid the qualifier against a team who's failed in the Champions League. Still really annoys me that like your reward for failure in one competition is to go into a competition you've got a better chance of winning. It's ridiculous, really, but. But we are through. It was another 1-0 win, another João Pedro penalty, and the fourth penalty that he's had this season, and the fourth of which wasn't given on the pitch.
Fourth in that competition, isn't it?
No, yeah. But I think the one at Marseille wasn't it, straight away when Lamptey was tripped? I think that was given straight away.
Yes, I think you're right.
You might be right. The two which he was involved with at home to Ike, and the one away to Ike, were all not given. And first time I looked at a replay, I thought that has to be a penalty when obviously play continued. I'm talking about the one last week. And then obviously it was, you know, pretty quickly I was typing away and there was a reporter next to me who says it's going to be a penalty because he was going over to the screen. So I think why it wasn't given first time, I'm not quite sure, but you could say that about the two at home to Ike. I don't know if you want to talk about the game itself, because I don't think I've seen a Brighton team under De Zerbi dominated as they were for a lot of that first half and unsettled to that degree.
Again, I can't help thinking, we had this discussion when we played Ajax at our place. They're playing the game, they're playing the moment, they're playing the occasion. And it's just, yeah, I mean, Ajax are better than, certainly in their build-up, they're better than their European adventure has would see fit. But thankfully for us, they just can't finish. I mean, some of our finishing has been woeful. I mean, you go back to the Potter days, obviously, but thankfully against us, they couldn't finish. So, but with regards to the penalty, I wasn't 100% sure at the first time. Obviously, I was watching it in England as to whether it was. And I can understand why the referee didn't give it first time round, on account of the fact that the little clip of Pedro's boot that ultimately sent him down was almost glancing. I mean, it was in replay, it was clear, but because it was effectively almost on the blind side of him. I mean, the foot goes down, it lands on his foot a bit, but when you're from looking at it from that side, I could see why he wouldn't give it. But, you know, it's we're not back to necessarily a whole thing of referees thinking, well, I've got VAR, so I don't have to make a decision. But like I say, I mean, what seemed to be coming across, certainly from the commentator, and we had Adam Virgo commentating for us, what came across was is that they were looking at it. And I actually thought that the ball was supposed to go out of play before the referee has a look.
See, that I was going to raise that. That was a weird one. I thought that as well. I mean, there's been a couple of things with VAR that we've learned this week, such as we'll come to the Chelsea game later.
Yeah. Well, I think it actually works better, the fact the referee does stop the game, because let's face it, the ball was in a relatively neutral area.
Yeah.
You know, he can start with the drop ball to whoever had the team who had the ball at the time. And let's face it, that could have gone on for another 2 or 3 minutes before you go back to that. And I believe that if you have a penalty incident and then look at VAR, that you're supposed to play that extra 30, 45 seconds, 1 minute, whatever it is, you're supposed to go back and play it at the end of the game, I believe is the case.
Yes, well, I think time that's lost.
I think that's the case. So I think in that sense, it was, notwithstanding the referee missed the trip, but in that sense, it was a good use of VAR and good, you know, stop the damn game here, because this is as clear as you're going to get it.
And it was fairly quick, wasn't it? I mean, if you think back to the Forest game, we had that incident where Brighton could have scored easily.
Yeah, it was Jack double jeopardy.
And then it would have gone back. You would have had... It was bad enough. It was penalty awarded, red card. Imagine if it had been gone back. Goal disallowed, penalty awarded, player sent off. And that could have been an incredible triple jeopardy, wouldn't it? But no, I think if you're going to get to a decision quickly and it's the correct decision, I think, you know, it's fine. We're sort of getting used to how it works as well, aren't we? I mean, I had the same pretty much the view that you would have had on TV, because I was sitting up right next to the TV cameras. But it was when I looked at a replay and I thought, well, that looks like he's actually clipped him. And initially I thought, if the referee's right there and he hasn't given anything, maybe not. But anyway, yeah, it was...
But as you've already said there, though, Brian, you know, Ike weren't there to make up the numbers. They had plenty of chances. Verbruggen had to make a couple of very, very key saves. But we also had lots of chances ourselves. A very early one for Evan Ferguson. And we also saw a corner just from that Ferguson chance where saw Lewis Dunk head across goal, but Ferguson couldn't quite apply the finish. Now, that's what I wanted to talk about here, guys, because we scored from a corner at Chelsea, and it looks like we're actually, it's almost worth us having a corner again. It looks like we're actually working on them.
Yeah, but we also conceded from the very same thing.
Well, this is true.
Yeah, Alan got there for me.
Okay.
No, you're right, though. That was, and also from across, like Joao Pedro with the header at Forest. So, yeah, there was one game, I can't remember what it was, at the Amex, and they were coming up with some different moves, and none of them actually came off. But it did look then like they were actually working on. There was one where it was played in low, laid off, and somebody had a shot. I'm forgetting exactly who it was. And then the next one was played deep, and Dunk headed it back across. So it looks like, yeah, they are working on different variations.
And Pascal nearly scored twice from a corner at Ajax.
Yeah, went straight for goal, didn't he?
I know.
Exactly. But what seemed to happen, I mean, after those first 5-10 minutes, couple of chances, De Zerbi's magic football will only work if players are that well drilled that it's not just a case of knowing what they are doing. And they all do clearly know what they're doing. It's just not doing it. And actually, again, interesting on the commentary, Adam Virgo, you know, sort of blasted most of his ire at João Pedro. And there is that move that we have where we're playing it across the back and then we play it into the middle of the park where a forward is coming back who will then touch it off to a midfielder. And seeing as that forward has come back and the defender has followed him, there's now a gap behind them. What they're saying is that João Pedro couldn't trap a bag of cement and kept giving the ball away too much. And certainly the last 10 minutes of the first half, it seemed to be one-way traffic and they seemed to really sort of zoom in on him. That's not to say he was the only one that was doing it, far from it. But it was getting frustrating that there's all these Albion players. Yeah, they probably looked a bit tired, but they knew what they were doing and weren't doing it. And that's why I think, you know, even the commentators were finding frustrating. Steve Sidwell and Peter Crouch, and you know, thinking this isn't Brighton at all.
I keep meaning to, I haven't got around to watching it again. I keep meaning to, but what I can recall is huge amounts of space behind the Ike defence. And you're thinking they should be able to play somebody in there. And it looked like they might do with the Dinger a couple of times, but it wasn't forthcoming. And it was just a real feel of, Brighton just having no time and being suffocated on the pitch and off the pitch. And the crowd were feeding off that, and they could really sort of fear. And they knew this was sort of their last chance to salvage their. And if they'd have won it, obviously they'd have gone level on points with the head-to-head with Brighton and with Ajax to play. So it was a big game for them. And also they had this stat about them never having won a home in the Europa League. And I think also playing a Premier League team, I mean, Almeida called Brighton €200 million team in his press conference, which wasn't quite right. But you could feel
it.
Momentum and building on and off the...
Yeah.
It wasn't a wall of noise like at Marseille. It was a noise which depended on what was happening on the pitch. And the one thing if I can just say, AD, you know, when you get to the end and you think you'll be glad that the halftime whistle comes, they really need halftime to come here. Because even after the hit the post and the header over, there were still a couple of other chances.
Yeah.
And I was literally typing up some update and the players were walking off the pitch. So there was no, I think there was no added time.
No.
And you couldn't hear the whistle because it was so loud. And I put, you know, Brighton will never be so relieved to hear a half-time whistle, although they probably didn't hear it. And it was like sort of almost your dreams, not dreams, your wishes are answered in a way. You think, could do with half-time coming here. You look up, they're walking to the changing rooms.
You could do with half-time coming along and you realise it's only 25 minutes gone. You think, oh, my God.
I mean, you said that there was space open. I mean, obviously, this was after the red card as well, but... there was that brilliant run from Igor where he just strided majestically up the pitch and played in Evan. And you would put money on Evan to score, but I think he tried to get around the keeper, didn't he? But it was
the one room to do that. He was so good, Igor, by the way. He just exuded calm, but also looking like a nightclub bouncer as well. He just had
his
he was just what you needed in that on that occasion.
It's bizarre, isn't it? I know football's a game of opinions, and hey, what's the Albion Roar if not a show of opinions? But I've seen it, and from more than one person on social media saying, Igor, he's just not a Brighton player. Get rid as soon as possible. And I'm thinking, what game you watching? You know, even then, you kind of as you pointed out, AD, the bloke is huge. And you think, you know, this is a sort of a lump that's there, sort of almost like an upgrade on Shane Duffy. But then you forget, well, we got him from Fiorentina.
He played in the Conference League final last year, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So, no, I'm quite happy with Igor. And when he gets to do that, like I say, sort of bursts through the middle, it's scary because you think, well, their defenders have now got a tank bearing down on them.
Yeah. But you know, it was. I mean, we're going to talk a bit more about Igor and Mr. Red Chelsea because I mean, I thought he was immense in that game as well. But yeah, I mean, as far as Ike were concerned, I think they'd be quite pleased to finish third and go into the Conference League because I think they feel they've got a better opportunity in that competition. But you know, just before we move on from this game, and this seems to be a recurring theme this week, there was a debut for young Josh Duffus in this game at Ike, Brian. And he looked brilliant when he came on.
Yeah, I mean, it would have been really nice if he'd have... Actually, I thought Belaba did well in that moment too, and it would have been really nice if Duffus had put that chance away. I think there was a flag up, but I'm not even sure if it was offside again.
It looked like it was level. They'd have to draw the line.
Of the opinion, if he'd have stuck it in, they'd have still looked at it in the same way. Because the flag at the end of the day is almost irrelevant now because there's no such thing as... level and therefore no such thing as umpire's call on that. So it wouldn't have made much difference. Yes, if you'd have stuck it away, I'm not convinced it would have been offside. And then you'd have had... And I know that you and your colleagues across the journalism world, across the newspaper world, Brian, would have gone, Christ on a bike, have Brighton got another 18-year-old scoring kid?
Is that what he is? I'm not sure how old he is. He's 18. But the thing was, he played because of the regulations on academy players playing in Europe, which I not totally understand, but you have to be with the club for a certain amount of time. Hence, Marco Marni wasn't there because he hasn't been with the club for, I think it's 2 years. So then Duffus then played for the 21s the following evening at Fulham, and that O'Marni didn't play, and he didn't play because he was going in the squad to Chelsea for the Sunday. So, there was about three others, I think, who were on the bench unused in Greece, who then played for the 21s at Fulham on Friday. So, going from about 22 degrees to about zero.
Well,
there was Tom McGill, if you remember, he saved two penalties at Forest Green on the Wednesday night recently and was on the bench at Ajax on Thursday.
It's just, isn't it?
I think someone posted a tweet this week. I think it was from February 2021, highlighting that two under-16-year-olds were making their debut for the Albion under-21s, Jack Hinshelwood and Josh Duffus. So, there's your point about being with the club for at least 2 years, certainly. Because, I assume now that Jack Hinshelwood is therefore considered officially a first-team player as opposed to... He's not going back to the under-21s anytime soon.
De Zerbi said that in his press conference today that he doesn't consider him to be an academy player. He's under-21s. He went to America, didn't he? He spent pre-season. So he's Josh Duffus, apparently, the pronunciation. But what De Zerbi does with his pronunciation of Hinchelwood, I haven't quite worked out yet, is if you have a listen, it is a tricky name for him.
Okay. Okay, well, you are listening to the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb, 97.2 FM, online at RadioReverb.com, on DAB, and, of course, on our podcast. As ever, this show is brought to you in association with oldfootballshirts.com, and we have got a lovely little shirt for you this week. Brian, can you have a go at describing this one for us?
Yeah, so let me just find it. So it's blue. It's a sort of Rangers-type blue with... actually, it's Czech, so it's a darker blue and then a lighter blue. That's the top half, and the bottom half is all blue. Sponsored by Ockham Civil Engineering. And it's got a badge. Am I supposed to be seeing this badge?
Yeah, you can see the badge.
Something that helps you.
No, was that ACFC? And it was 2004, so a relatively new club. And there's some, I don't know what that is. It's almost like a candle in the middle. Or an anchor, sorry. No, it's an anchor with a over the sea and then the land and then the sun. So yeah, ACFC formed in 2004. They wear blue, and they're sponsored by Ockham Civil Engineering. I mean,
you've got no idea who it is here.
I've googled it, to be honest, but I had no idea.
When googled it.
Yeah, Alan, you're both trying to cheat today. This is
I'm telling you, I googled it. I don't know who it was. I mean, I thought, is it some sort of non-league team or a non-league team who come through the ranks?
It does look like a non-league shirt.
No, I'm going to guess here, because I think that Ockham Civil Engineering is based in Auckland in New Zealand. And I actually originally thought it was RCFC, and it could be ACFC. So is there a club called Auckland City Football Club?
Auckland City FC? What, you mean the shirt of this is?
Yeah,
there is.
I'm guessing there, because I actually thought it was RCFC, and therefore I thought, well, I don't know any clubs in Auckland.
Moving swiftly on, here is your shirt of the week, chosen because it was added to our website whilst Phil was away in Greece, and also because he has absolutely no idea what colour it might be. It's blue, Phil. This is the 2022 home shirt of New Zealand Northern League side Auckland City FC. Northern League sits at the second level of football in New Zealand. There's also a Central League and a Southern League. And at the end of the season, the top teams from the three leagues compete for a possibility of promotion to the top flight, the National League. Auckland City, as Brian said, were formed in 2004, at the time in the New Zealand Football Championship was formed. They play at the 3,250 capacity Kiwi T Street Stadium, which they share with Northern Regional League side Central United FC. Auckland have an illustrious history in top flight football in New Zealand, having won the league 12 times and the Grand Final Cup 8 times. They've also won the Oceania Football Confederation Champions League 9 times, including 7 in a row between 2010 and 2017. They reached semi-finals of the FIFA Club World Cup in 2014, which was ultimately won by Real Madrid. Links to the UK are a little bit scant. Alan Jones managed the side from 2004 in their inaugural 2 seasons. He spent time as a coach at Bristol City, Blyth Spartans and Darlington before taking the New Zealand national team manager's job in 1984. Some former UK Auckland players include Jeff Campbell at Wimbledon, John Irving at Everton, Tim Payne at Blackburn, Dave Mulligan and Clayton Lewis both played for Scunthorpe. For a link to the Albion, Phil thought he found one. There is Oscar Garcia, played for Auckland in 2015, but it's the wrong Oscar Garcia. There is a very, very tenuous link to the Albion. Jose Manuel Figueroa managed Auckland Youth between 2008 and 2011 and was there as first team coach between 2019 and 2021. He was born in Crawley and played for Crawley Town until the age of 19. When he quit to pursue a career in coaching, which he started in 2003 in the Albion. So there we go. So thank you for that, Phil. Of course, you can see that and over 130,000 other shirts over at oldfootballshirts.com. And thank you for your continued support. Now, just a quick thing on the notice board. congratulations to our good friends over at Dogma, who have won the quite prestigious FSA award for the best fanzine, which is absolutely brilliant. This is an award that where Kieran Maguire was at the awards last night with his Price of Football podcast, but he couldn't quite bring home the trophy, but Dogma did, so congratulations to them out.
Absolutely, yeah, absolutely. No, it was superbly done. Before we move on to the Chelsea game, I'm not getting too bogged down by things, hopefully, on this. There has been a missive come out from the Premier League that there is the next round of TV sponsorship money, and there will be a continued blackout of Saturday 3 p.m. matches on UK televisions. Now, I'm going to guess here that those who are for and those who are against is going to be a roughly age demographic demographic split. Not 100%, obviously, but I would be of the opinion largely that older people who've been going to football for yonks are in favour of the blackout, and those who see football as a reality TV programme might well be a bit have the hump with that. I'm going to throw it open to you two. Where do you stand on the Saturday 3 p.m. TV blackout in the UK?
Well, I mean, you know, well, it's well known that if the Albion aren't playing, then we'll go and watch someone like Worthing or Lancing or Burgess Hill or Whitehall. You know, there isn't a proven statistic that actually says that if a game's on the telly, then people aren't going to go and watch their local teams. And basically, taking a classic example, Worthing is a really good example to use. Their attendances when the Albion aren't playing do tend to go up, but their attendances are generally over 1,000 anyway, which for the tier they're in and the size of the club that they are, is really, really good. And when they have a game against like Bognor, for instance, you know, you can see get 2,500 people down to Woodside. Now, will you get 2,500 people down to Woodside if Brighton are on the telly? There is
anyone's on the telly. If anyone,
well, I mean, I'm used. Obviously, we've got to use Brighton, and this is a Brighton show. We're just using that as an example. I mean, Man United are on the telly regardless of whether you want to watch them or not. I mean, who does actually want to watch them at the moment, because they're terrible? But I just think that, is it time? I mean, you've got iFollow in for the Championship and below. Those is iFollow in operation for 3 o'clock games, Brian? I don't know.
No, I'm, to be honest, because I'm at games, I don't really know. And if I wasn't at a game, I would either do something different, or, you know, a Brighton game, or go and watch my local side. So yeah. I mean, this whole thing still exists, doesn't it, on Tuesday and Wednesday nights, where you've got Champions, you've got Eastern League, League Two, whatever, going up against Champions League on the TV. So it does exist there, and I don't know if it makes difference.
That's a point I was actually going to raise there, actually. And again, it's something that Kieran Maguire tweeted earlier this week. He said, or today rather, I was saying that there is empirical evidence to point out that when there's certainly EFL, now we're not talking grassroots, we're not talking tier seven, but I think that the point is still making. When you're talking about leagues 2, 3, and 4, when they've got a game on, when there's a Champions League week on, then yes, the attendances do suffer. They are lower. I couldn't tell you what the percentage is. Now, that's a microcosm of it. And I think there's the other thing that we have to consider here is that when you've got live games on in Italy or Spain or whatever it is, what you've got is so much more is focused on, like you'll have Real Madrid will be on at the same time as everyone else, and Barcelona will be on the same, because that's where people are intrinsically drawn. Because, yes, we still have the big clubs, yes, we still have those that the draw on the telly, but because we have the football supportership that goes down further through the pyramids, my point would be is that the fans spread themselves a bit thinner. They don't all congregate at the top. A fair whack do, of course they do. But the point you're making about in tier six, excuse me, of Worthing getting 1,500 is not copied anywhere else across Europe. And so that would be my concern is that those numbers would be affected by a live Premier League game, whether it was Brighton and Worthing, or you could say Manchester United and probably most of the country, or Manchester City or Spurs or Arsenal and most of the country, as opposed to Brighton and, say, clubs in Sussex. So that would be my primary concern. The other part of it is that, yes, Premier League games are, for the most part, sold out, so you can't get any other tickets.
And they're expensive.
And they're expensive, but my point would be is that football is not a reality TV programme.
It's not a TV show, full stop.
Absolutely. So my point would be it's a sport. First and foremost, it must serve those who turn up and watch the game.
No, the other thing I would say is, where do you watch TV these days? I watch it on my phone. So even if it was televised, you can still take it with you. But I'm not a big TV football watcher, to be honest. I would rather go and watch the local game.
Yeah.
Other than that said, after going away 3 days, I don't do football on a Saturday if there's not a break.
Yeah. I'm told I watch too much football as it is, but, you know, there we go. Okay, well, just before we move on the chat, congratulations to Roberta De Zerbi on winning the Golden Boy Award, following the lead of Tony Bloom, who got the Golden Boy Award for best executive. So that is brilliant. Hopefully, that doesn't have the same curse as the Manager of the Month Award.
The only thing I'd ever say is, I've got to be honest with you, and I don't know how many people I speak for here. I've never heard of Golden Boy before, so.
We've got a player who's won it,
which is,
well, I'd heard of the boy bit, but I didn't know where these other headings. But
Jude Bellingham won the award this year, but I can't remember his name. He's the guy that's on loan at Arnhem at the moment.
Kozlowski.
He won the young player a couple of years ago. But you know, it's another string to our bow. It's another feather in our cap. It's congratulations and and it stops us from talking about Chelsea. So that's also good. But Chelsea,
we're going to have to, don't you? You know, we have to.
I know. Now, obviously, they're one of the players that is involved in this one. Mudryk should have seen red in the first couple of minutes, Brian.
Should have had a card, I guess, and there was that penalty shout as well, wasn't there? But it was so many of those talking points, so much confusion. You were sitting right next to me while I'd just been moved to the press box and still getting myself set up and plugged in. But
I know I ended up having to sit half the seat.
Actually, Brian? They did actually start okay in the game, and then I just felt Chelsea bit by bit getting a foothold, and their crowd bit by bit just starting to wake up.
Well, I think it was actually more than anything. It was the first goal that just woke Chelsea up. They had that 5 minute spell. I mean, they had their other sort of couple of chances, and there was times again, like with Ajax, we were being a little bit sloppy. But they had their two chances in the 5 minutes. Apart from that, it was largely an even Stevens game.
Yeah, but it felt
pretty much. It was Enzo who gave him the lead from the scoring from a corner, which I don't think should have been awarded as a corner. I saw that it was a handball by Mudryk in the build up to the ball that he put across that Igor put out for the corner. But but VAR doesn't check those, so it's
Wasn't it before that though? There'd been a couple of dangerous situations, and Igor had come in with that header.
Yeah.
And slight was, if that was before, I'm trying to remember now. So I sort of felt that they were getting on top when they scored the goal. But what was at the press conference today, what was quite interesting was De Zerbi, he said it was a stupid goal, that they conceded stupid goals. And he actually pinpointed who wasn't doing what they should have been doing on that goal. And it's probably, as we saw it, Ferguson and Baleba with how they were trying to mark in the middle, where Fernandes scored with a free header. And I've looked back at the photos to illustrate that story, and you've got photos with no Brighton players on them.
Yeah, it was zonal marking. I mean, there was two players lying right next to each other. Like when Enzo jumped for the header, I can't remember who was right with him, but basically they were both going for the same ball, and there's no Brighton player anywhere near them. I mean, I thought the nearest player, the Brighton player to them, was probably Lewis Dunk, who sat next to us.
Yeah, I thought Baleba, even on the second goal as well, he probably, as for his stature, he needs to do a bit more defending in the air at those old-fashioned English goal-mouth scenes when Cole got up above him.
I mean, it's one thing that, you know, that Ferguson gets all the critiques that he gets, and fair enough to him, but a lot of the time that the Brighton get their plaudits is when they're on the ball and they're moving it around and they can actually keep the ball and let's look at the back of the, and I still watch it now and again, the 30 pass move to the, you know, to when we scored our second goal against Manchester United, and rightly so, we get great plaudits. But what we don't get so many plaudits for, I mean, it's not so much when we don't have the ball, because we do close down pretty well. It's when it comes to those set pieces where everyone has a specific job. And, all right, you've highlighted, or De Zerbi's highlighted two players in the middle there. But there's been times when a certain player hasn't got back. You know, in his early days, Adingra would not help out Estupiñán or whoever he was playing in front of.
And it's those tracking back even now.
It's driving RDZ round the wall, round the twist, because he knows, even though we think, oh, you know, the crash bang wallop we get, the kamikaze football we get, yes, we're going to score, but yes, we're going to concede. But if you're not going to do things that even as a page one defensive unit you're not doing, then, I mean, thankfully, you know full well they can improve. But by the same token, they should also be doing it as well. And the plaudits should be possibly held back a little bit so that each player who's, you know, doing their job gets credited for that as well.
Yeah, it's surprising, Brian, that the only clean sheets we've had this season have been in Europe.
There's been moments of fortune in Europe, which they haven't had in the Premier League. And maybe it's just that also a sign of a little difference in quality. Premier League teams being a little bit more ruthless. I mean, if you think back, Ajax, there was that shot that hit both posts. And there was that incident late in the first half against Ike. So, yes, it is a bit of a quirk, isn't it? That's three, and it's since the half-hour mark at Marseille, they haven't conceded. So that's, you can put an hour on top of the three clean sheets. Yeah, perhaps it's who they're playing against and a bit of good fortune. Perhaps it's a little bit coincidence as well. But,
well, every now and then you get you are going to need a little bit of good fortune. And like you said, that shot they hit by post in Ajax, that was one of those. But it was you know, you've still got to be able to defend. We scored in every game, but we haven't kept a clean sheet in the league. It's something that at some point it's got to change.
It's no point. I mean, at the end of the day, a football game is won purely by the whole notion of scoring more than the other team. And if that happens to be that if we don't concede at all, then the worst we're going to get is a draw, then fine, fair enough. And we do seem to hang a lot of cachet on keeping a clean sheet. Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I think the reality is that we should be pleased by the fact that we score more than the other team and therefore, you know, win the game. And under De Zerbi, that's always going to happen. But having said that, like I say, those defenders do know how to defend. Those attackers know how to defend. And at times they just don't do it. And that's what I think, that's where they're, you know, De Zerbi the tactician is one thing, but then De Zerbi the coach. This is why the whole notion of the fact that Real Madrid are interested or so-and-so is interested, he's still got to be a coach that sorts out a defence first.
Okay, well, Brian, let's look at the positives in this game. And we were both discussing it during the game, weren't we, about Facundo Bulanotti, where his best position is. But I mean, Roberto came out after the game and he said that this was Facu's best game in the stripes for us.
Yeah, if you can picture the scene in a packed press room and there was more reporters than seats, so we're standing up, sort of looking over De Zerbi, who's sitting down, and all the questions are about referee, VAR, and then when he doesn't want to talk about a referee, why don't you want to talk about a referee?
That was quite funny though.
Then he said something like, did he say that he wasn't sure what happened or he didn't see what happened or something like that?
Oh, no. He said the first question he got asked was, I see nothing. I saw nothing. I see nothing.
The first question was, do you feel hard done by? And he said, about the result, yes. And they were trying to make him talk about a referee. And then when he didn't want to, it was almost like taking inference from that. So there's national reporters. It's all the nationals there because it's Chelsea and... So the questions are all about the confrontation. Everybody wants to talk about that. And I'm standing there thinking, I want to do something about Facundo Buonanotti's goal. and they're going to be looking daggers at me. And it was just a moment of silence when nobody's asking anything. So I was looking straight at him. I said, something a bit more positive. What was that the moment we've been waiting for from Buonanotte? And then he started talking about how well he thought he did in general. And he spoke a little bit about other young players. So then I asked, yeah, but what about that goal? How important will that be? Because I did a piece, I put it up, it's a subscriber piece. So hopefully people can see that. It's I thought it was fitting. He scored it where Enciso scored his breakthrough goal. And he scored it pretty much at the same time as McAllister scored his breakthrough goal for Liverpool, considering that he's, you know, their compatriots and he's his mentor, really. He's almost like his idol, McAllister. So what I've been quite impressed with Buonanotte is, bear in mind, he's only 18. I know he looks older, he plays older, he speaks older, but he's still an absolute kid. And I've been quite impressed by how he's just been putting himself about and been busy and sort of industrious. And we were saying that, weren't we, when he was in front of us, that he's actually putting a shift in. And then he produced that moment, which I guess is what he's been signed for, what done a lot in Argentina. I found a clip of a goal almost identical, actually from further out, for Rosario Central. In terms of his best position, you can see, yeah, he's not a flying winger as such, but he can actually cut in and play like that. And is it fair to say he's the most similar to Solly March, in that Solly March isn't a flying winger, but he will cut in and do bits and pieces with the ball, be quite good with the ball, and also will do that tackling shift and just be a grafter as well. So I don't know if that's fair or not, but is he the most similar to what
I think Solly's certainly got more speed.
Yeah, he's quicker.
But I mean, I think Faku's possibly, I mean, he's got that South American flair and a little bit possibly more skillful than Solly, but Solly has got the know-how. But
I think if you're asking the question, I think personally, Facundo's best position is largely playing where Lallana has been playing, which is kind of the more advanced midfield.
As a 10?
Yeah. Well, it's not even that. I mean, I don't think you can be quite as staid as that, because the front line is often quite fluid. It's not even the case necessarily that Ferguson leads the line or João Pedro is there or Lallana's there. But what I do mean is that he does have decent link-up play. I personally think he's wasted out wide, although having said that, we frankly at the moment don't have anyone left. It's just that the only thing I'd ever say about it is he's got Lallana's skill, but he doesn't have the experience, and it's knowing what he should be doing. Once he's on the ball, fine, he can do something with it. But it's when he doesn't have the ball, it's knowing where he should be, what he should be doing. And Lallana has that mountain of experience where Buonanotte really obviously doesn't. And I think it's therefore you kind of fit them in, you know, for want of a better term, out of the way.
Yeah, but Brian, it's interesting that Roberto was talking about, not just with Faku, but with Baleba and a few others as well, about their physical condition and not being able to play 90 minutes, he feels.
But he thinks, listen to him today, I think he thought he probably should have left Buonanotte on for longer. That felt like a four-way substitution. That almost felt pre-planned. He more or less said today as well, he wants to make substitutions where he can judge it on the game and make a decision on what's happening and not on how many minutes each player should get. But he seemed to think he should have leave Buonanotte on for a bit longer. I hope that's a bit of a launch pad for him, because, you know, they've all taken a while to make their mark, players who come from South America or from Japan. And it might have been that they've taken the time here, or it might have been it's been on loan. But the ones who've been sort of overnight have slotted straight in, and the more experienced people like Ucurea and Estupiñán. So, you know, like I say, he's 19 just before Christmas. He's a sort of a long way from home. And the one thing you can see is he's willing to work. He's put a shift in. So hopefully it gives Brighton that extra. I mean, he's getting Brighton's first choice 11 if they're all fit, but it's a 16-man game, and it's two 16-man games a week. Yeah. So 16-man game a week. So,
well, this is it. I mean, he really got thrown in at the deep end, and we signed. You know, you forget we only signed him this year, this calendar year, and under most other circumstances, you'd say, stick him out on loan to, you know, usually be Belgium or somewhere, you know, into the Low Countries or something like that for a year, just to get acclimatized. The only reason we did that with Caicedo, because of his, the numbers and the points and what have you. But Buonanotte, they chose not to send him out on loan and throw him in at the deep end. And you can still, the odd thing is like, it's almost like he's on loan to us as our own player. It's, he's being built up bit by bit as a rookie in the first team. Under other circumstances, that could actually be quite dangerous. And in that sense, I'm quite glad he hasn't made it flying out the traps in the first few weeks, because then the pressure would be on him to maintain that. And that's what I feel sometimes there is on Evan Ferguson. Buonanotte himself, there are games where he'll start and he's completely anonymous. Fine. But, you know, so long as he learns from that experience, then it's one game closer to being the player that hopefully that we always intended to sign.
Yeah. I mean, we saw about Julio as well, didn't we?
Yeah, exactly. He did very little until it was the goal at Bournemouth, wasn't his first goal?
Yeah.
And he did bits and pieces in the game before, which I think was Brentford. But it took him a while. And I can remember talking to Johnny Cantor quite well into the season, saying, like, I don't know what he's got. He doesn't seem to have great pace. He doesn't seem to have a trick or anything. But they have. And it's just give them time. And as De Zerbi always says, young players need to play. There's no substitute for that.
Well, one young player that did play was Benicio Baker-Botti, who made his full bow coming on as a sub in this game. So that's two youngsters in two games. I mean, Al, at the beginning of the season when we do our
just
pre-season
have to mention
prediction,
this.
We didn't do it this year.
No, because we'd have lost count. But one thing I would say about, I was thinking about it earlier when we were talking about the Ajax game earlier, was my prediction for leading scorer was going to be João Pedro, just because he takes the penalties.
Yeah.
At the moment, I think I'm looking good on that. So, for the question of how many of the kids are going to make it into the first team this season, well, I wouldn't mind betting that probably by the end of the season, it will be not that far short of an 11.
Well, I don't think it's going to be there, but maybe
three or four
Cup
into that now, like, easily. Plus, there'll be an FA Cup game, and we've got Stoke away.
Yeah,
deep joy.
The audible groan in the press room when they made the draw on Sunday was palpable.
Knockings, AD. We have to talk about what on earth happened at the end. I'm not talking about the ruckus. I'm talking about the penalty, non-penalty.
Yeah, well, we were sitting there. Well, firstly, I wasn't sure it should have been a penalty for Chelsea for the third goal. Bizarrely, Roberto De Zerbi was convinced it was a penalty. Pretty much everybody else, Warren Aspinall, was convinced it was. Most other people thought it probably wasn't. It was sort of that incident where a player makes a run in the space where his opponent wants to be, and it happens all over the pitch many times during the game. Anyway, penalty given. But you're talking about the one where the ball hits Colwill, and we're sitting there, me and AD, looking across, and Wilson is sort of putting his hand out, but it was
reluctant. He pointed to the spot. He did point to the spot.
Pointed, but he didn't. The way that he pointed made me think
sheepishly.
Yeah, sheepishly. Yeah, I don't know if reluctance is not the right word, but it was. And I was talking to a couple of people at the press conference today, and they saw it the same. So, well, he's sort of pointing, but he's like not quite sure. But what I would say with that is, when you list what happened, ball hits player, referee points penalty. He's told the ball hit him on the head, looks at the screen, no penalty. And it all sounds like it should have been so simple and so quick. And that doesn't... Why did those few things lead to so much confusion?
Some of the confusion is down to the fact that people don't necessarily understand the game. I've got to rewind a couple of years ago here. There was a similar thing that happened. I was up at Villa Park. Solly March got given a penalty against him. Referee gave the penalty. VAR looked at it, saw that Solly had just nicked the ball first. So in a situation like that, if a penalty is overturned by VAR, then the game stops and it's a drop ball to the defending side, no matter what else has happened. But the weird thing is, and I was watching some American program, and I've yet to look up the actuality to it. Now, the ball had gone in the case of the Chelsea game, the ball had gone out for a corner before Pawson pointed to the spot. That, I think, does make a difference as to what happens next. Now, what was clear is that Pawson, what he didn't do was give a corner. that is clear. That much is clear. The irony is that if he'd have given a corner, then VAR would have still looked at the thing and would have said no penalty, hit his head, go with your corner. But because he gave a penalty, he had to do it the other way. But the query is that because the ball went out of play before he gave the penalty, should then play have continued with a corner after that? To my mind, the correct procedure was carried out. In other words, penalty given, gets overturned, it's a drop ball because it's been overturned rather than the corner. The only difference being is the ball already gone dead before Paulson had given the penalty, which may or may not have made a difference.
Yeah.
Maybe our listener has got a view on that.
Feels like an incorrect law correctly carried out.
Yes.
From what you said. But the other thing, there wasn't an old-fashioned assistant, i.e. linesman, standing looking straight at Colwill about 15 yards away, and why he couldn't have just said, or maybe he did, maybe you can't do that, but it feels like he should be able to tell the referee that ball hit him in the head, it didn't hit him in the arm.
What didn't help the situation was that Colwill stuck his arm up. If his arm was down by his side, then it would have been, well, just crystal clear. But he was jumping.
You try jumping with your hands down your side. It's impossible. It's one of those.
Yeah, but is there not a way though where the VAR could not say in his ear, that's not a penalty, it's him on the head. Simple as that. Rather than all that stuff about
well, if he's given it already.
Because if he's gone, once he's gone to the screen, you know he's basically it's a bit of a charade, really, isn't it? From what we
what's going to happen when they go to the screen. It's very rare that they come back and actually come.
There is only ball over the line or offside that the VAR can actually give the final decision. All the VAR can do is tell the ref, I think it's his head. Go and have a look. So it's the ref
Takes us back to the Ike game where they stopped the play for him to go and have a look.
Well, quite. So, like I say, I think I'm in with Brian on this. It's an iffy law carried out correctly.
Yeah. I still feel that having the chance to watch something again on a screen should be advantage. It should, yeah. Not slow motion. I don't know, you can get into whether it's slow motion, freeze frame, whatever. Just the general theory that being able for a referee to be able to watch something on a screen should be able to turn that into an advantage rather than in terms of getting more, and they probably do get more decisions right than they used to, but it's the ones that get wrong.
This is the thing, before VAR came in, 92% of the decisions were right. I take that.
I wouldn't. 8%, one in every 12 is horrific. How many decisions does a referee make in a match? 100?
What I'm saying, the sheer fact of being able to watch a decision, an incident again should be an advantage, surely.
Yes.
And it is, somehow it's been turned into a disadvantage.
Just quickly before we finish, there was an incident right at the end of the game, Brian, where there was a lot of handbags. Steele and Sanchez were having a little bit of a contretemps, weren't they? And Roberto was having a chat with the ref. And I very much like what Roberto said afterwards. He says, I was congratulating him on a great game. But that's pretty much all we've got time for this week. So thank you, as ever, to Alan Wares. Thank you to Brian Owen. I've been Ailey Packham. This has been the Albion Roar on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM. Online at RadioReverb.com. On DAB, and of course on the podcast. And in association with AllFootballShirts.com. Thanks so much for listening. We'll see you all again next week. See ya. Bye.